Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As Spain deals with ongoing austerity measures, the unemployment rate is on the rise. The unemployment rate among people under 25 rose to almost 51% in January. Since 2008, Spain's unemployment rate has doubled. The average Eurozone youth unemployment rate is 21%. In a new paper for the International Monetary Fund, two economists looked at 173 episodes of austerity over the past 30 years, and they found that it, quote, lowers incomes in the short term, with wage earners taking more of a hit than others. It also raises unemployment, particularly long-term unemployment. So what is ahead for Spain, and how are these important issues being covered? Guy Hedjico is co-editor of Iberosphere.com. That's a website that offers news, comment, and analysis on Spain and Portugal. And Guy's latest piece is called King's Big Game Fall Comes at Just the Wrong Time. Spain's royal family was already having enough difficulties before King Juan Carlos hurt himself while on holiday shooting elephants. And he took this trip in Botswana. It cost the equivalent of about $60,000 for this vacation. That's 2 years' pay for most Spanish workers. And Guy Hedjico joins us from Madrid. Hi, Guy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi there, Rose. Nice to be here.
It's nice to have you. And we're also joined by Gary Rivlin, journalist and author of Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. Gary is working on a book about New Orleans post-Katrina, and we're going to talk with Gary about coverage of unemployment and poverty in this country. This week, the House Agriculture Committee voted to cut $33 billion from the growing food stamp program over 10 years, and we'll also talk with Gary about the ongoing controversy over working moms. Earlier, a couple weeks ago, actually, Democratic strategist Hillary Rosen said Ann Romney hasn't worked a day in her life. The media have been covering it endlessly. So who's reporting on what moms actually face? And Gary joins us in studio. Hi, Gary. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, Russ.
Great to have you back. So as we always do on Fridays, we like to start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Gary, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
So John Cassidy at The New Yorker wrote a blog post that really captured nicely income inequity in this country. And he talked about the picket fence and the staircase. And basically what he did is broke income into five different categories: the poorest 20%, the richest 20%, and those in between. And what you see happening is post-World War II, between 1947 and 1973, income of all five groupings, all five quintiles, went up more or less the same. In fact, the poorest 40%, their income went up slightly at a faster pace than the richest 60%. But that starts to change in 1973 and then changes dramatically in the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s. So, you know, the first part, 47 to 73, is the picket fence. You know, just imagine a fence and all five bars are more or less the same height. But after that, it's a staircase. And what you see between 1979 and 2007, as John showed it, is that the lowest quintile over that 25, 28-year period, income rose 18% during that entire time. And you see the middle quintile income went up 35%, twice the rate during that same 27, 28-year period. But then you look at the richest 1%, and their income went up 278%, which in English means it doubled. It doubled again, and then almost doubled a third time. And the numbers he was using was stopped in 2007. And what we've seen is it's actually getting worse in the last few years. If you look at the top 1% in 2010, they captured 93% of the income gain was captured by the richest 1%. I thought it was just a few charts really just kind of capturing a huge problem we have in this country, or for that matter, across the globe.
And did he look at how we got here?
No, actually, not one blog post. I mean, to give Cassidy credit, he's written, you know, many long pieces on this topic.
I ask because it seems like these numbers are actually getting a lot more attention now.
Right. I mean, one great thing that's happened since Occupy Wall Street is I really feel like it was a hit to the head of the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we need to be covering this story. it is hard to capture just in a line or two, or in this matter, in John Cassidy's case, a single blog post. But, you know, it's the bigness of America. It's the Walmart effect, that what we're seeing is there's fewer and fewer companies. There are all these conglomerates, and the way they work, the way they win, is they pay low wages and pass things along to people at low prices. And meanwhile, the corporate geniuses that made this happen get their $10 million, $15 million a year.
And I wanted to give kudos to opinion writer Harold Meyerson at The Washington Post. Mm-hmm. It goes along nicely with the piece you just cited. It's called An Economic Recovery That Leaves Workers Further Behind. And he cites a Bloomberg report that says most of the jobs being created are in low-wage sectors. About 70% of all job gains in the last 6 months were concentrated in things like healthcare, home healthcare. These are unfortunately low-paying jobs, restaurants, hotels. But he also takes a look at corporations that are keeping their factories in the United States mm-hmm. instead of sending them overseas. And these jobs that used to pay $50 or $60 an hour are now paying between $15 and $20 an hour.
Right. And you know, truthfully, $15 an hour is a lot better pay than most of these new jobs. Right, what is it? 70% of the new jobs are what I would call low-income jobs. If you're making minimum wage in this country, $7.25 an hour, that means you're making $15,000 a year. You know, you've got two kids. I don't know how you're making it work. Even if you're a two-income family and you're both making $30,000 combined,
right?
I don't know how you're making it. And, you know, I remember around the Texas Miracle when Rick Perry was, you know, everyone's favorite candidate. You know, Texas had increased so many jobs, but finally I saw an op-ed piece. It wasn't in the news pages, an op-ed piece showing that the vast majority of those new jobs are under $10 an hour, i.e., they're not a livable wage.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks for that. And we'll put links to those pieces right after the show. And what about you, Guy? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, something that a lot of people are talking about over here in Europe at the moment, and I suppose in the United States as well, probably, is the French presidential elections, the first round, which is this weekend. And actually, the piece that caught my attention was not actually published this week, I was reading a number of different profiles of Nicolas Sarkozy, because I find him quite a fascinating character anyway. And there was actually an article published a couple of months back, which I found by far the most intriguing, by The New Yorker. It's by Philip Gourovitz, and it's called No Exit: Can Nicolas Sarkozy and France Survive the European Crisis? And it's very much still relevant now, as relevant now as it was when it was published a couple of months ago. And it looks at this extraordinary figure that Nicolas Sarkozy is, and how in many ways he's so untypical for a Frenchman and for a French president. The article starts: Nicolas Sarkozy, the president of France, doesn't like wine. He doesn't like smelly cheeses. He doesn't like truffles. He likes Diet Coke and candy and big Havana cigars. Such distaste for good taste is widely regarded as unnatural in France, but Sarkozy makes no apologies. And so you get the idea. He's known by many French as President Bling Bling, because he wears expensive watches, and as we all know, he's married to Carla Bruni. He likes holidaying on, taking vacations on yachts, and he's known for having supposedly an obsession with money. Now, when he became president, he won the presidential election in 2007. That didn't seem to bother the French. It was something new for them to have a president like this, and they seemed to kind of lap it up in a way. And Sarkozy, what he was selling to them was, in a way, a kind of American dream. He was saying something which was very un-French, which was, you know, you need to work harder. As a country, we all need to work harder. We need to work longer hours. We need to rely a bit less on the welfare state. And that's very much a taboo in a lot of parts of Europe, particularly France. And he's saying, you know, basically, we've got to be more American. And that seemed to go down well with a lot of voters. But 5 years on, he's extremely unpopular. It looks like he'll get through to the second round of the presidential election, but he looks set to lose the second round against the social democrat candidate, François Hollande. And he does seem to inspire now, Sarkozy, an enormous amount of This distaste that I mentioned earlier. There are a lot of voters who really just can't stand the sight of him. And a lot of that has to do with him as a person, not so much his political stance on issues, but him as a person.
And what does France look like right now in terms of austerity and unemployment?
Well, I mean, as the neighbor of Spain, you know, Spain is always looking over its borders, particularly to France, because France is sort of, you know, the big country next door. We've got Portugal on the other side, but Spain doesn't seem to take much notice of Portugal, much to the annoyance of the Portuguese. But France doesn't seem to be in as bad a state as Spain, certainly. I think if you spoke to the French, they would say things are very bad. I think they have unemployment, something like 4 million unemployed, which is very bad by their standards. Something that Sarkozy did was he raised the retirement age from 60 to 62. He would argue probably that's one of his greatest achievements, but that's something that many French are very unhappy about. The idea that you can retire at a reasonable age and enjoy a long, fruitful retirement is a sort of a sacred thing in France. And I think there's a feeling that 62 limit will probably get pushed further back and back over the coming years, quite possibly as well. But they're suffering austerity and unemployment, not as bad as Spain, but it is certainly bad over there. And I think that's one of the reasons why they look like they're going to change president.
Well, and we'll be covering this next week with a journalist from France 24, I believe. So we'll be talking about the elections in France next Friday. And Guy, speaking of political leaders that are out of touch with their people, let's start off by talking about coverage of King Juan Carlos going to Botswana on this elephant hunting trip that cost $60,000, which, as your colleague Teresa Albano points out, is 2 years' pay for most Spanish workers. Talk about how the public actually found out about this vacation.
Well, they found out about it because King Juan Carlos, he had an accident there. He slipped while he was vacationing. He wasn't apparently actually wielding a gun when he fell over. I think he was somewhere near or at his hotel, and he slipped on a step, and he broke his hip. And because he broke his hip, the royal machinery, the royal household, had to inform the Spanish public of this, and issue a communique. And so it sort of came out, by default. They didn't presumably want to have to announce this, but they kind of have to when something like that happens and the king is hurt. So they announced that he had hurt himself, and they had to obviously say where he was and what he'd been doing. And then there was a bit of confusion because the government seemed to give the impression it didn't know that he'd been on vacation in Botswana, certainly not shooting elephants. And the royal household insisted it had informed the government. I think that the government felt slightly sheepish about this because it looked like the government was sort of rather in cahoots with the king in not letting people know, or at least not stopping the king or trying to stop him on going on such a lavish holiday when Spain is in such a deep crisis. But it did look very bad from that point of view, certainly from the point of view of most Spaniards who I think were surprised, because this was unusual for the king, because he's known for having a good common touch. Whenever there's some kind of national tragedy or an air crash, for example, he's one of the first public figures to be there comforting victims. And he's been known ever since the transition to democracy in the late 70s and the early 80s as a king who's very much in touch with his people. And I think one of the big things about this news story is that this seemed to sort of overturn that whole idea about Spain's king very suddenly, and change people's image of him, rather.
A 2006 photo of the king standing next to a dead elephant is now circulating in Spanish media. Did he actually shoot and kill an elephant on this trip?
Well, the elephant issue, the fact of whether he was killing elephants or not, or shooting elephants, hasn't been confirmed by the royal household. They confirmed was that he was in Botswana vacationing, and then the media got hold of information which suggested that he was shooting elephants. We haven't heard whether he actually shot any on this trip. He was apparently accompanied by a very expensive local guide, who charges a lot per day, And so thus the news about the figures that how much had been spent coming out. But no, we don't know the status of his hunting record in Botswana.
And is that public monies? Is he going on vacation on his own dime or on the public dime?
Well, it's the other thing. I mean, from what we've heard, we haven't had confirmation of this either, but a newspaper did report this was paid for by a Saudi prince, I believe. I'd have to check now, but this is what one newspaper was reporting, which then sort of raised other issues. I mean, while it's not the taxpayers' money, it sort of, you know, there were questions about, you know, why is this Saudi prince paying for this? You know, what's the reason behind that? Is there some kind of tit for that tat thing going on with business deals, or is this a thank you for something that the king's done? So that kind of opens another can of worms.
You can't make
the feeling is it wasn't on the taxpayers' dime.
You know, Guy, you can't make this up because your colleague Teresa Albano, she reports that the king is also the honorary president of the World Wildlife Federation of Spain, and this is an organization that's supposed to save elephants, not shoot them.
That's right. I mean, right? Well, that's the other reason why. I mean, I suppose the main problem he's had with this story, the main, you know, point of criticism has been that he was vacationing in Botswana in such a lavish way when Spain is in such economic trouble. But the other point of criticism has been the environmental argument as well.
So getting to this economic trouble, the Spanish government is slashing budgets by 30%. According to news reports, the palace budget got a mere shaving of 2%. And then these new unemployment numbers look horrific. The unemployment rate is on the rise. Among people under 25, it rose to about 51% in January. And since 2008, the unemployment rate has doubled. How is this being covered in the media?
Well, I mean, this has been a phenomenon that's been going on, you know, in one shape or form for the last two or three years, really. Since 2008, late 2008, unemployment has been soaring. And, you know, the problem that the first of all, the socialist government that was in power until the end of last year, and now the new conservative government are having, is they can't slow it down. So, I mean, it's very difficult, I think, for the media to give anything other than sort of fairly negative coverage of the government's attempts to get unemployment under control. I mean, this conservative government introduced a very controversial labor reform just a few weeks ago, which has been its main gambit in terms of trying to tackle unemployment. But that was, well, I say a few weeks ago, that was in February. It's already implemented. And, you know, clearly it hasn't had the desired effect. The government says it needs more time, but it flexibilizes the labor market. It makes it easier to hire and fire, the idea being that it brings Spain more into line with other European countries and the global economy. But clearly that hasn't worked. So, I mean, the coverage on that area, on the government's its attempts to bring unemployment under control, is pretty gloomy at the moment, because that's been the main policy, and clearly it's not working. And the government itself has said, you know, unemployment is going to keep rising this year. We can't wave a magic wand. I think that is, as much as anything, a sort of an attempt to kind of preempt the negative coverage.
And that is Guy Hedjico, co-editor of Iberosphere, a website that focuses on news and analysis of Spain and Portugal. We're also joined by Gary Rivlin, journalist and author of Broke USA. And Guy will be with us for about another 6 minutes or so. So if you have any questions or comments about coverage of what's going on in Spain and the economy, now would be a good time to call 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org, or better yet, post at yourcallradio.org. And Gary, do you have any questions for Guy about coverage of the economy in Spain?
Well, what's interesting to me is that, I mean, what Europe's going through and what our country's going through are different, but in a way you could boil it down to the same debate. At least I see the debate going on here, where the GOP, the Republicans here, would say austerity, 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 and the Democrats, the Obama administration, has been pushing for stimulus. That, you know, the last thing you do when you're in a recession, when unemployment is so high, is cut off government spending. And, you know, we saw the stimulus in this country, which was much more modest than the Obama administration wanted, but it's helped keep our unemployment numbers in check. They're still too high, but at least they're heading slowly in the right direction. And, you know, I've thought about in the context of Greece and Italy, and now we're talking about Spain, that, you know, they too are going through austerity measures exactly at a time when, if government would do some spending, the unemployment rate can go down. I'm not surprised there's not a magic wand in Spain to bring unemployment numbers down, because they're not using the magic wand that, you know, Keynesians have been using for decades. I'm curious if you agree with me, Guy, here.
Yeah, well, these sort of issues tend to get very divided along sort of ideological or party political lines, and it's become very much sort of left versus right on this in terms of the labor unions, social organizations, left-leaning groups in general are clamoring for more investment, certainly not more austerity, and are saying that the reason that unemployment is still going up is because of the austerity, and that unemployment should be the priority. I mean, I think the problem that Mariano Rajoy has as prime minister here is that he's not just fighting unemployment. He's not even just trying to get the economy back on track in terms of economic growth. His main target, it seems, at the moment is to please the European Union, to please the technocrats in Brussels by bringing the deficit down. And by definition, you know, if he's bringing the deficit down, certainly he's probably not going to bring unemployment down. He's fighting on two fronts, and it's very difficult.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to David in Berkeley. Hi, David. Welcome to the show. Hello, David? Sorry, let's go to Max. Hi, Max.
Good morning. Thank you for a good program and for taking my call. I have a couple of questions about Spain. What's the stance of the Spanish equivalent of the Occupy Wall Street movement? I think they call it M15 or E15M. From what I understand, last year in November, they refused to support the Socialist Party, one would argue, with disastrous results. Not that they could be blamed for it, but the Socialists lost the majority in the central government. But in addition, although the Socialists have done fairly well in Asturias and Andalusia, if I'm not mistaken. So can you talk a little bit about that? And it seems to me it would be interesting, perhaps you'll do that next week, to talk about the rise of Jean-Luc Mélenchon in France. That might have serious implications for the next government, given that the Socialist candidate Hollande is likely to win. I'll take my answer off the air. And thank you very, very much for a very good program.
Thank you, Max.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a good question about the what they call the 15M movement, the 15th of May movement, or the Indignados is how they're often known here, which is, you know, the sort of the Spanish equivalent of the Occupy Wall Street movement. I mean, they kind of seem to wax and wane. I mean, they rose up in May of last year. That was when they first appeared. Quite very early compared to many of the other equivalent movements in the United States and Britain, for example. And they had a huge impact at the time. They seemed to have a huge impact on local election campaign at the time, and really drive home to people that at least the two main political parties, the Partido Popular, the Conservatives, and the Socialists, well, I suppose you could call them Social Democrats in American terms, were not offering a campaign that Spanish voters were interested in. They weren't speaking to their concerns and their worries enough, and they weren't, in a way, representing Spanish people enough. So this new movement tried to address that problem. It didn't offer any solutions, but it did highlight that problem.
We have to take a quick break. Can you stick around for a couple more minutes?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. And you can join us, 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, which has been broadcasting at 91.7 on the FM dial since 1941. With online listening now, KALW has listeners worldwide, so just because you live in the Bay Area doesn't mean KALW's online streams aren't for you. If you hear KALW at work but not at home, or lose reception on your commute, check out the online listening options at kalw.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we're joined by Guy Hedjico, co-editor of Iberosphere.com, a website that offers news and analysis on Spain and Portugal. Gary Rivlin is a journalist and author of Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have any questions or comments about Spain, Guy will be here for just a couple more minutes. And if there was a story out there that you thought deserves more attention, we'd love to hear from you. And then we'll switch gears a bit and talk about poverty in the United States. And thanks again for calling in, Max. And let's hear next from David. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi there.
Hi.
Well, I just wanted to comment on how mildly hilarious it is to hear this whole brouhaha about the king of Spain spending $60,000 on a, you know, Botswana hunting vacation. It's sort of like in the Austin Powers movie when the bad guy says he's going to destroy the whole world if he doesn't get $1 million. You know what I mean? It's like, hey, he's the king of Spain. They have a king. They don't want him to go on these trips. Throw the bastard out, you know? I mean, we live in America. We got rid of our king because we didn't approve. It's kind of like, if you want a king, $60,000 hunting vacation, I don't know. Much better to capitalize on the hilarity of him being the representative head of the World Wildlife Foundation and shooting elephants, if you ask me.
Well, thank you. All right, thank you. Guy, well, quick response?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. At the risk of sounding like Dr. Evil here, it's a very much a symbolic issue here. It's not even the amount of money. It's just how it looks, you know. That I think, you know, it looks also as if he wasn't using taxpayer. He wasn't going on vacation on taxpayers' money. We talked about that earlier. But it's just the fact that last week, when Spain's borrowing costs for its 10-year bonds were over 6% for, you know, the first time this year, and it looked like people were talking once again about Spain possibly needing an EU bailout and joining Portugal and Greece and Ireland. And just at that time, you know, possibly Spain's worst week of the year economically, that was when the king was off in Botswana. And it just showed a lack of sort of nous in that sense, you know, not being in touch with things. I think, yeah, you're right. It's in the big scheme of things, it's not a huge amount of money. But it's very much a symbolic issue.
Well, and speaking of that, to talk more seriously about symbolic issues, Guy, have you heard about Dimitris Christelos, a 77-year-old retired pharmacist who shot himself in the head near a subway exit across from Greece's parliament on April 4th?
Yeah, I had heard the story, yes.
I've been surprised that this didn't get more attention because there was a huge tribute for him a couple of weeks ago, major protests. And then the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Greece's suicide rate has greatly risen after their economic crisis. Record suicides have doubled since before the crisis to about 6 per 100,000 residents annually. About 40% more Greeks killed themselves in the first 5 months of this year than in the same period last year. And a lot of these suicides are being attributed to the economic crisis.
Yeah. I mean, I have no idea what the equivalent figure is in Spain. I haven't seen the suicide rate. But I mean, I know, for example, last week I was covering a story for an American medium, and I had to go to a soup kitchen where they hand out food to poor people early in the morning, so breakfasts on the outskirts of Madrid. And there were some really shocking stories there. And I spoke to the organizers and asked them, you know, if there are more people going now than a couple of years ago. And they said, well, yeah, there are four or five times more people coming right now than, say, 2 years ago. I mean, it's just unbelievable. People who can't pay their mortgages, who just don't have enough to buy decent food, pretty much everyone who can't find a job. And you know, obviously we haven't got to the stage where we're like Greece quite yet, but obviously that Greece story shows the tragedy that you can arrive at when things are that bad in the economy.
Gary, his family actually said he was making a political statement with the suicide. Did you hear about this?
I just heard about it right here. But, you know, the tragedy of what's going on, we see it state by state in our country. Two things are happening. Hard economic times, more people losing their jobs mean more people need to rely on, you know, food stamps, on some government help through hard times. And we also are having austerity measures. We also are cutting. So we're cutting the very programs that are meant to help people. The insane example to me is job training. We have cut job training roughly in half, depends on the state we're talking about, at a time when we need job training. I mean, this is a time when people are idle and they need to be rejiggering. They need to be coming up with new skills for the new economy. You know, adult education, I know in New York City where I live, adult education is a 2-year waiting list. These are people who want to go back to school. We should be encouraging that. Oh, that's so great that you want to improve yourself and increase your earning power, help our economy. And yet there's a 2-year waiting list, and that's typical in states around the country.
And Guy, before we let you go, what are you working on right now?
Well, I'm working on the website on Iberosphere. I'm following the economic situation very closely, and also actually there's an article that I'm working on which is a bit lighter, which is not really much to do with the economy. It's looking at the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, which, you know, is like kind of like a little sister of the New York Guggenheim. That is 15 years old this year. And so it's having a lot of exhibitions and shows and events to commemorate that. And so I'm looking at that and how, you know, the development of the Guggenheim and how the Guggenheim Museum has transformed the city of Bilbao. And so there a phrase has come out of it, the Guggenheim effect, which is how one building or one project can transform a whole city. And that's very much been the case in Bilbao in northern Spain.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Guy.
It's a pleasure, Rose.
Guy Hedjico is co-editor of Iberosphere, a website that offers news and analysis on Spain and Portugal. And you can find his work at yourcallradio.org. And Gary Rivlin will be with us for the rest of the hour. He's a journalist and author of Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. And we're going to talk with Gary about coverage of poverty in the United States, budget cuts, and then we'll also talk about the endless media coverage that we've heard and seen over the past couple of weeks about Hillary Rosen's comment about Ann Romney. So if you have any thoughts about that, we've already received a few emails on that one. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also give us a call, 866-798-8255, or leave your story of the week, a link at yourcallradio.org. So Gary, since you just talked about job training and education, I wanted to cite the numbers in this Harold Meyerson column in the Washington Post. He says that the standard wage at Midwestern auto factories has declined from around $28 an hour to $15 an hour for workers hired during the past 2 years. New hires have their hourly wages contractually capped around $19, no matter how long they're going to work for the automaker. And then he writes, there's a new high-tech locomotive plant in Muncie, Indiana. Caterpillar is hiring workers at $12 an hour, which is about 24 grand a year, 30 grand if you're lucky to get overtime, to assemble some of the most sophisticated machinery that this country builds. And so his point here is, how are people supposed to pay their bills when they're making 12 bucks an hour? And this is a pretty good job at Caterpillar.
Right. It reminds me of this great story The Atlantic ran a few months ago by Adam Davidson, Planet Money, now contributing to the New York Times Magazine, where he looked at one plant that's, you know, doing it right. They didn't offshore it. They're keeping it here in the U.S. And you kind of feel sympathy, clearly, for the worker who's making, I think she was making $10, $12 an hour with no prospects of ever making more. Her supervisor talked about how great employee she is. She comes on time. She's very good at her job. But, you know, it's almost like a return to what we had 100 years ago. If you have technical training, you have potential at the plant that Adam Davidson wrote about to make a very good living. But if you're just a cog in the factory, you'll never make a living wage. I mean, I wrote a whole book about, right, you know, what a plum opportunity this is for businesses. If you're trying to get by on $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 a year, you're always falling short. Hence, we now have a $40, $50 billion a year payday lending industry. You've probably paid a lot of bills late. You've messed up your relationship with the banks. You suddenly can't have a bank account. And so there's 17, 20 million people who don't have a bank account. That's the check cashing industry, which is, believe it or not, a very huge industry. There's six publicly traded companies in the check cashing business, or seven if you include Walmart, which has gotten in over the last few years. And so, you know, people's suffering, the struggling of the working poor, has given rise to almost a misery industry. Those that are targeting those who have no money in their pocket and are constantly falling behind, have lousy credit, and so are kind of at the whims of business to make ends meet.
Meyerson also is reporting that when you look at the Standard & Poor's 500, their cash reserves have increased 49% in the past 4 years, in large part because they're either not hiring in the U.S. or they're not boosting workers' incomes. In 2007, companies generated about $378,000 in revenue for every employee. Today, it's about $420,000. But those profits are not being shared. And he said the reason why is because workers have lost all of their bargaining power.
Yeah, exactly. The profits are being shared, but with the CEO and his or her top people. My favorite story of this week, you asked at the top of the show for best reporting, but right. My favorite story of the week is shareholders in Citigroup, Citibank, voted down the pay ray, the pay package that Vikram Pandit, the CEO of Citi, gave himself, a $15 million pay package for last year. And when I say shareholders, you know, I mean the big institutions, CalPERS, you know, the pension funds, you know, wealthy individuals, that it's so out of whack with what we're seeing. It's non-binding. It doesn't make a difference that the shareholder said that's not right. 55% of the shareholders said we don't agree with that. He could still get his pay package because it's non-binding. Something that Dodd-Frank had attempted to do, but like many elements of Dodd-Frank, it's kind of stuck in regulation and regulator interpretation limbo, is said that every publicly traded company needs to give a figure showing the differential between what the average worker gets paid and what the CEO gets paid. Because one of the great crimes of the last 10, 20 years, where the CEO used to make 20, 40, 50 times the average worker. Now, typically, it's 300-400 times the average worker at his or her own company. And so he says the profits aren't being shared. He's mostly right, but they're being shared at the very top.
How long have you been covering these issues?
Oh, kind of off and on for 25 years, but specifically the last few years, this has been my topic.
Okay, so I am seeing a lot of good coverage on these issues.
Last couple of years, it's really changed.
Right, so what does that mean for the population, especially those who are struggling? Their stories are being told, and does it matter?
Well, I think where my criticism would be comes down to, wow, look at the suffering of these people. Mm-hmm. And I wish they would take the next step and say, wait, were there government policies and business policies that got them there? Mm-hmm. And what are ways business policies and government policies are preventing them from turning them around? I mean, the example I gave of, you know, cutting training is a perfect example. Another one is credit reports. We all have our FICO score. What, you know, how good is our credit? You know, lousy credit's 500, 600, good credit 700, 800. And this has become such big business in this country that FICO scores are not only used for what rate you're going to pay on a bank loan or an auto loan. Increasingly these days, they're used for whether or not you're going to get a job. So a large percentage, 30-40% of businesses out there, especially when they're hiring lower wage employees, they get the credit report. And so think about that. Someone's lost their job. They're desperate for work. They want more work, but they've been late in paying their bills. Their credit score goes down, and now they can't get a job because their credit scores are down. How do you expect people to get out of a hole? control if we're going to have policies like that. So that's where my criticism would be, that there's really lots of very good, heartfelt reporting that puts a spotlight on the problem. I wish they'd go the extra step and now say, okay, what is government doing that doesn't make sense here? What are some business policies that we should put the spotlight on? So perhaps we could start thinking about turning this around.
And you're going to be working with Barbara Ehrenreich on a project to try to do just that, right? Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of Nickel and Dimed.
Right. So we're trying to fund innovative reporting with foundation money, not with our money, that, you know, tries to get more of the core reasons, that really tries to put the spotlight not just on the suffering, but on the policies beneath the suffering.
And that is Gary Rivlin, journalist and author of Broke USA. And we've got about 10 minutes left. So if you'd like to comment on coverage of these issues, we'd love to hear from you. If there was a story that you'd like to highlight, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also post it to yourcallradio.org so others can see it. And let's go to Carol in Woodside. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the show.
I'm glad to have this opportunity because I've been stewing all week about this statement by Hillary Rosen and Ann Romney about women's work.
Yes.
And I thought about it. It reminded me of the olden days, going back to Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, Flo Kennedy and that. And Flo Kennedy had a statement, I believe, that every woman is one man away from welfare. Huh. That's an aspect that hasn't really been brought into this conversation, in that women who are staying at home, raising children, doing all that work, it's very hard work. It's worthwhile work. But in the end of their lives, they don't have a retirement unless their husband has planned for it or their significant other. They don't have health care. They don't have Social Security, and it's not even measured on the GNP. So there's all that work that's done, very difficult work, worthwhile work. It should be honored, but they get nothing for it monetarily.
And Carol, I'll give the context for this story in just a minute, but as you said, this has received endless coverage in the last 2 weeks. What did you think of the coverage? Do you think that any of what you just mentioned came out?
Well, I didn't hear it. That's why I'm calling in.
Oh, okay. Well, it sure it got.
I haven't heard any of this part come in from it.
Okay.
I've just heard the sort of the going back and forth.
Yes.
About the woman's vote. They think they want the woman. This party wants the woman's vote. That party
right.
wants the woman's vote.
So here's a little bit of context. Mm-hmm. So Mitt Romney has been on the campaign trail trying to kind of talk about women, talk about their struggles, because he is far down in the polls when it comes to women. And he said, I talk to my wife. She talks to women on the campaign trail. She knows what their struggles are like. She knows what it's like to struggle. So Hillary Rosen, Democratic strategist, who's not working for the Obama campaign but is a big financial supporter, goes on CNN to talk about this issue and says Ann Romney has never worked a day in her life. Now, that comment got so much attention within hours.
Seconds
and hours. And you had everybody from Joe Biden to Barack Obama to Michelle Obama, David Axelrod, their top three campaign strategists, who took to Twitter to say, every mother works hard and every woman deserves to be respected.
Yeah, exactly.
And
they didn't say what I said.
Well, they didn't say what you said. And they also didn't point out, and Hillary Rosen said what she was trying to say, is that Ann Romney does not know what it's like to struggle. And she's lucky because she can make the choice to stay home. But a lot of that got lost. Gary, what were your thoughts about how it got covered?
It's just the line, she hasn't worked a day in your life. My spouse and I, we have two kids. We did a Freaky Friday thing. I took care of the kids for a week, though she would probably, if she's listening, say it was more like 3.5-4 days. And she was doing some, you know, she worked full time. And I'll tell you, that was harder than work. I mean, so it was the use of her words. She hasn't
right.
worked a day in her life. She's worked her tail off raising five boys. I don't doubt that for a half a second, especially, right. you know, she's had some serious illnesses to deal with as well. It's just, I wish the focus had been on, Ann Romney can relate to the woman making $20,000 a year trying to raise two kids. She's got two Cadillacs. I mean, her cars cost more. Each of her cars cost twice as much as what the average woman, you know, single mom is making. And so it just she just got the debate off on the wrong foot. And until an NPR report I was listening to this morning,
yeah.
I had not heard a single thing that gets to the points you're raising, Carol. How, you know, that if you don't have the freedom of that choice, what your life is like.
And this piece was by Jennifer Ludden, Working Moms Challenges Paid Leave Child Care. And she interviewed a woman, Marianne Bollock. Her 18-month-old had a stomach virus. She threw up. She called in sick. Her employer fired her, saying they'd rather have someone without a child. And I was so glad that Jennifer pointed out a fact that has not been pointed out in this debate, and that is the U.S. is one of the only developed nations with no federal policy requiring paid leave.
Right.
So why do you think...
And we don't have equal...
There's so many laws.
You know, we don't have equal pay here. I mean,
why do you think that we don't hear... I mean, this is a ripe time for the media to really focus on what women's labor actually means. The fact that 45 children... Out of every 45 children, one is homeless. That's about 1.5 children. Why do these facts... Why is it... It's like a big deal that NPR actually points out this important fact.
Yeah, we have 20-25% of the children in this country living under the poverty line. You know, I mean, I would say two things. One, on this story in particular, the media by and large, especially cable television, they don't look beyond the horse race. So the only thing that mattered is that the Obama side of things tripped up giving Romney an opportunity, right? The story until that was that, you know, Romney every week seemed to be tripping over his own feet and giving opportunities to the Democrats. So, you know, so much of the coverage is just that horse race, who's ahead, who's behind, to whose advantage. And it was such a lost opportunity to me, because this really is a fascinating topic. You mentioned something in the intro to this show. The Agriculture Committee this week slashed food stamp money, where millions of people would be thrown off food stamps again at a time when misery is high. And even those who are on it would take a huge cut in their monthly allotment. Meanwhile, big corporate farms, which gets a different form of welfare, that was left untouched. I couldn't believe that wasn't a page one story. I mean, that's a story that just kind of captures a really interesting policy debate. I think that would have been very interesting would have made for a very interesting story looking at the policy. But policy is a harder story to tell than a political campaign that Ann Romney scored, but then she was overheard the next day, a couple days later, at a birthday party, gloating that she had an opportunity to best the Democrats. And so suddenly there was criticism of her. That's a very easy story to tell. It fits into nice categories. Policy stories like we're talking about, you really have to struggle. You have to figure them out, how to tell them in an interesting way. You have to sell your editor on it. They're much harder to do, much harder to pull off.
We have an email from Leslie who says, the Republican attempt to frame this as an issue pitting women against each other is obscenely cynical, and we should not buy into it. And thanks for the email. Let's hear from our next caller, Marcia. Hi, Marcia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I just wondered how much Mrs. Romney pays her help.
That's a good idea. Good question.
Yeah, well, there's those two Boston Globe reporters who did a very in-depth account of the Romney life. So I'm sure if we had them as guests, they would know. But yeah, I have no idea. She has a lot of help, right? How many homes do they own? At least three.
I think five.
Yeah,
they own five residences, and of course, there's all the places that they stay where they're not resident.
Right.
And I'd like to know what kind of help she has.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't help you on that.
Yeah, an enterprise.
Good question.
Enterprise reporter should go after that story.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you for calling in. Is this what we're going to get in the next 7 months?
Yes.
Gary? Just this sort of shallow coverage that doesn't really offer much substance?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the way we cover campaigns in this country. I mean, you know, it's now we have blogs of all kinds and so much more media, but largely it just means amplifying the coverage. It's, you know, who made a gaffe, who's ahead, who's behind, you know, what does it look like in Ohio today versus last week versus next week as far as the campaign, which, by the way, is all interesting stuff. I love those kind of stories. I just wish they would take the opportunity. A second point I wanted to make before about reporters and lack of writing about this stuff is so much of... I worked for a big daily newspaper for years, and so much of the way the job is approached is the candidates, are they talking about it? Mitt Romney spoke for half a second about the very poor, and it was a gaffe, and he had to apologize for saying something to the effect, I don't care about the very poor.
Well, but, yeah, but that was a CNN interview with Soledad O'Brien,
right.
But it wasn't really a gaffe because he said, I don't care about the poor. If there are problems with the social programs, I will do something about it, but I don't care about that. Now, Soledad O'Brien should have said, well, that social safety net is unraveling, Mr. Romney. What are you planning to do? And she didn't. But he said it twice.
No, right. It was an expression of his policy. It was just a gaffe in that he said it out loud. Yes, you're absolutely right. But my point is that the Obama camp isn't talking about the working poor. The Obama camp isn't talking about people making 20, 30 grand a year.
Right.
It's all the middle class. The middle class.
Yep.
And yes, I mean, the middle class could use help. The middle class is a legitimate story to talk about. But what about the people at the bottom of the economic period? What about the people that we've been talking about, the home health care worker who makes $15,000 a year, the security guard? I did a series of interviews with the janitors of Wall Street. I found Anthony Adams, who empties the garbage at night at Goldman Sachs. And I just want to find out about his life. Well, he works two full-time jobs. He works 80 hours a week to make ends meet. His wife also works. She's a crossing guard 4 or 5 hours a day in her community. And just kind of his life and what a struggle it's been working at Goldman Sachs. Well, meanwhile, Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO, got 10, 12, 14 million. I can't remember the exact number last year. And this was true up and down Wall Street. It's this disparity that we're not getting much attention to, that we're not paying in the press much attention to.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for joining us. Gary Rivlin is a journalist and author of Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. Thanks, Gary.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Great to have you. And I'll be moderating Berkeley Vegan Earth Day on the 22nd on Sunday. You can find more information at berkeleyveganearthday.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on Monday. How is poverty changing the U.S.? On the next Jura Call, we'll have a conversation with Tavis Smiley and Cornel West. They've written their first book together, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. What are we facing in this country, and what will it take to get us out? It's Jura Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Support.
Next time on Smiley and West from PRI,
we'll be joined by the Oscar-winning songwriters Brother Alan and Sister Marilyn Bergman.
What mood have we been engaged to heighten? That's the inspiration.
Plus, a surprise guest.
Barbara Streisand.
Oh my God.
You don't want to miss this.
Next time on Smiley and West.
From PRI.
Smiling West at 1 p.m. right here on KALW San Francisco 91.7, your local public radio station. Coming up next from the World Service of the BBC, World Have Your Say. And then, of course, at 12 o'clock, it's Tavis Smiley. The time is 11 o'clock on KALW San Francisco.
Hello, I'm Nuala McGovern. Welcome to the BBC's World Have Your Say. Well, will you be watching?
Cancelling the race just empowers extremists. For those of us who are trying to navigate a way out of this political problem, having the race allows us to build bridges across communities.
Bahrain's Grand Prix is set to take place on Sunday. Activists say there will be 3 days of rage. But this weekend is about more than a car race. The event has become a flashpoint in the battle between Bahrain's ruling royal family and anti-government opposition groups. You may have heard two members of Force India pulled out after a petrol bomb exploded near their car as they were caught up in a protest in the capital. Now, some Formula One fans are calling for television viewers to boycott broadcasts. We want to know, will you watch the race? Give us a call now. Skype BBC_Wise.